Welcome to Ideas and Issues. I'm Hugh LaFollette, Professor of Philosophy at East Tennessee State University. My guest this evening is Frank Wu, Professor in the School of Law at Howard University, and we're going to be discussing neither black nor white, Asian Americans, and race relations. Glad to have you with us, Frank.
It's great to be here.
In this series, I mentioned the whole series to you, I've been discussing various issues about the nature and the role of race, cultural diversity, the English-only movement, immigration, and affirmative action. In a number of the writings that I've seen of yours and in our conversations, you talk about the way in which the experiences of Asian Americans are different in some ways than the experiences of other minorities, and that reflecting upon these experiences can illuminate, to some degree, all of these issues. So what I'd like to do is to sort of run the gamut and discuss a number of issues about the way in which Asian American experiences help us better understand these issues. Let's begin by talking about race itself. How, in your view, does the experience of Asian Americans sort of shatter the ordinary way that many people think about race in this country?
Well, I think it's important that I start off by pointing out something that I strongly believe in, and that is that we should look at the Asian American experience not just for its own sake, not to promote the egos of Asian Americans or to make them feel better, but because there are lessons in this experience, just as there are lessons in all of our experiences that apply across the board, things that we all can learn. And I also should mention, there isn't a single Asian American experience. There are many of them. The Asian American experience for someone who just arrived 5 years ago from Vietnam, who had a perilous boat journey, is very different than that of the fifth generation Japanese American whose great great grandparents came here at the turn of the century. And so there are many, many different experiences, but there are also some commonalities. And I think even at the very basic level, at just the level of facts, no matter what you believe about what we should be doing about civil rights and race relations, it's important that we recognize what's happening in this country. This country is changing. It's changing demographically. Today, only about 75% of the national population is non-Hispanic white. And what people who study this say is that within my lifetime, whites, like everyone else, will become racial minorities. So, you know, the country has never been just black and white. There have been Asians in this country since the 1860s, and even some prior to that. Asians were involved in the gold rush in California. They helped build the Transcontinental Railroad. There were some very strange plans to import Chinese coolie workers into the South after the war to take the place of recently freed black slaves. So Asians have been part of American history, but a part that's been ignored. And what's happening now is we're finally waking up. We're recognizing that this country is increasingly neither black nor white. And it's not just more groups, but it's more individuals who are multiracial. If you take a look at Asian Americans, our marriage rates, our outmarriage rates to people who aren't Asian Americans, are almost 50%. So you have so many people who are part white, part Asian, part black, part Asian, and all sorts of different mixes. I'll just throw out a few names of some famous people who we don't normally think of as being Asian, but who actually have some Asian ancestry. Movie star Keanu Reeves, for example. Superman on TV, Dean Cain. Supermodel Naomi Campbell is part Asian. And golfing sensation Tiger Woods. So those are just a few of the people. So I welcome this kind of discussion. It's a real opportunity to explore some of these issues and to take a look at where the next century is going to take us.
Well, in thinking about the issue of race, I mean, one of the things that it strikes me as very difficult for whites to do, and I mean, I say this as a white American. Normally, I would not think of myself as a white American. I mean, if you asked me to describe myself, it would never occur to me to say I'm a white American. And yet it seems to me the reason why I wouldn't is that because I'm in the majority group. And other people who've not been in the majority are almost forced by circumstance to identify themselves biracial classifications.
You know, I think that's absolutely right. And it's interesting, even that's evolved, because 50 years ago or 75 years ago, whites saw themselves as being part of very distinct ethnic groupings. People would have identified themselves as Polish or Italian or German in a way that we don't quite understand today, in a way that corresponds very closely to the way we think of race. But I think you've raised a very perceptive insight, and I'll share a personal story. You know, I teach at Howard University, which for more than a century has been the leading law school for training black lawyers. You know, there was a time when blacks couldn't go to school elsewhere, and I don't just mean law school, I mean couldn't go to college, and had to turn to the historically black universities. And there's something very interesting, as someone who's Asian American, being on the faculty at a predominantly black institution, and I'll share it with you. What's interesting is people of all races, and I mean some white, others black, and a few Asian American, nice, well-meaning, sincere people, when they meet me and find out that I teach at Howard, I promise you that the first or second thing anyone says when they learn that, almost everyone, is, well, what's that like? Isn't that unusual? Isn't that strange? Isn't that different? Isn't it a challenge to be the only Asian American at a predominantly black institution? And here's what's interesting about this. You know, when I was thinking about where I wanted to start my teaching career, I looked at a lot of law schools. And the vast majority of the 175 law schools in this country have never had an Asian American on the faculty. You know, they don't have one now, and they never have. And most of them, the faculties, are overwhelmingly white. I don't mean just 50% or 60 or 70 or 80. I mean 90, 95, 99% white. Some of the law school faculties in this country don't even have someone who's black who's on the tenured faculty. And yet, most people, I think, if I'd gone to one of those law schools and started teaching there, they wouldn't think to say, well, isn't that strange being at an all-white institution or a predominantly white institution? And here's why. Because to be Asian American among whites, that's just normal. That's being upwardly mobile. That's assimilating. But to be an Asian American among blacks, to make that choice, that's suddenly striking and remarkable. I think it just shows white and black aren't the same. We might say that we're colorblind. We might even aspire to being colorblind in a very genuine sense. But we aren't, because even when we think we don't notice race, what instead we're not noticing is the law school other than Howard, which has a faculty which is overwhelmingly white. We don't look at it and say, there's a white law school. So I think you're absolutely right about this.
In fact, that sort of gives us an avenue into the next topic. I mean, the way you described the reaction of many people is that they expect you to be in a white law school, or expect that it's possible for an Asian American to be in a white law school because it's seen as being upwardly mobile, but not in a black law school. And that has to do, I think, at least in part, with the perception of Asian Americans, that they are more hardworking than other groups. And that comes into play in people's interpretation about the issue of affirmative action. People, well, I'll just sort of throw in your court now. Would you talk a little bit about the Asian American experience in the view of affirmative action?
Yeah, I'd love to. You know, it's interesting. This stereotype has been around for a long time, and it's hard to complain about it because it's a positive stereotype. It's the model minority myth, this idea that Asian Americans are these super minorities. You know, we've overcome discrimination. We're doing well. You know, we're doing so well. We're making money. You know, we've assimilated. We've been accepted. And yet, it's not that simple. Like any stereotype, this flattering, complimentary stereotype can conceal a lot of things. And I'll just tell you about three things it conceals. First, it's factually inaccurate. It misses a lot of things. First, it misses the fact that for about 80 or 90 years, Asians couldn't just come to this country. They were barred. There were laws that said if you were Asian, you couldn't come here to become a U.S. citizen. And then in 1965, that all changed. All those laws were changed. But what's interesting, what happened after 1965 is this pattern of brain drain that I'm sure you've heard of, where the Asians who came to this country were the very highly educated ones from the countries where they were coming from. And so you have a very distorted perception here in the United States of Asian performance and how well Asians do and how hard they work and how well educated they are, because it's only the cream of the crop, as it were, that came here shortly after 1965. The other thing that factually is incorrect about this comparison, people sometimes say, well, Asian American families make as much or more than white families. That's true, but here are three things it conceals. One, it conceals the fact that Asian Americans, on the average, are a little better educated, so that when you're comparing equally well-educated individuals, Asian Americans actually make less, and that's according to the bipartisan Glass Ceiling Commission. Second, it conceals the fact that there are more Asian American individuals contributing to family income, and that's true of all racial minority families. They tend to be to have more dual earners, you know, both parents work, or even kids and grandparents putting into the pot, you know, the family income. So it inflates family income. The other thing about Asian Americans is they're concentrated geographically. They're in New York, California, and Hawaii, most Asian Americans. And those are states that have incomes that are just higher than the average nationally. So it's just factually inaccurate. I want to make sure that people know that Asian Americans aren't making more money when you compare people with the same schooling and you look at not families but people. Now, the second interesting thing about this model minority myth is what happens when times are bad. When times are bad, the same traits that are praised suddenly become sinister, because to be hardworking, that blurs over into becoming unfair competition, you know. Being smart means being one-dimensional and too bookish. Being good at math and science means you don't have people skills. You can't become a manager or a leader. And so each of these compliments is double-edged. It's a double-edged sword. Each conceals an insult of sorts. And the third, I think, most troubling thing about this image is that the reason it's been invoked is to denigrate other people of color. Let me just quote for you. There was a newspaper article written in 1966 by a sociologist named William Peterson, and it was called Success Story, Japanese American Style. And that's where this image comes from. And in this article, Peterson explains that Japanese Americans and Asian Americans faced all sorts of racism, and they overcame it. And then he goes on to say, he makes this point, and I'll quote, generally, this kind of treatment, as we all know these days, creates what might be termed, quote, problem minorities, unquote. And so it's interesting, this praise for Asian Americans is very explicitly for the purpose of insulting other racial minority groups. So you have to ask yourself, why suddenly do people look at Asian Americans and say, wow, Asian Americans are doing so well? And I think we have to be very careful.
All right, thank you. But before we go on and talk about that a bit more, I'd just like to welcome any listeners who may have tuned in late. I'm Hugh LaFollette. My guest this evening on Ideas and Issues is Frank Wu, professor in the School of Law at Howard University. What you just said, I think, was very illuminating about the ways in which there are certain myths about Asian Americans, and that those are often used by critics of affirmative action. As an Asian American, what is your view about the appropriateness or the legitimacy of affirmative action?
You know, I think that Asian Americans, like all Americans, are troubled. On the one hand, we want to do everything we can to make sure that there isn't racial discrimination. And I don't mean just historical racial discrimination. I mean racial discrimination that's occurring right now. You know, there have been the big lawsuits concerning Denny's and Shoney's. And if you look around at housing segregation, police brutality, you know, social scientists go out and measure this. And they can measure and document that there is racial discrimination out there, mainly directed against blacks, but also some directed against Asian Americans, Latinos, and others. And so we want to do something about that. But on the other hand, the way affirmative action works sometimes doesn't do it quite as well as we'd like, because sometimes it helps people who we may look at and say, well, those aren't the right people to be helping. And then sometimes it hurts whites and Asian Americans, because Asian Americans, you know, are sometimes included and sometimes not included. So I think for Asian Americans, this is a very difficult issue. We're helped, on the one hand, by affirmative action here and there, but on the other hand, sometimes we're hurt by it. And we certainly owe a debt to the civil rights movement and to the laws that came out of that. I think Asian Americans sometimes don't realize that. But I'll tell you what I think the more important question is. I think the more important question isn't, are we going to have affirmative action or not? The more important question is, what are we going to do? We shouldn't be debating what is just one tiny part of a much broader package of civil rights reforms. We should be asking, well, if not affirmative action, then what? And to the people who want to abolish affirmative action, that's the challenge I would give to them, to come up with something else. Because the real question is, what are we going to do to advance racial justice? And for Asian Americans, I think it's important they recognize, because both color consciousness and color blindness can help and hurt them, and affirmative action can help and hurt them, that this isn't about self-interest. This ought to be about principles, taking the high road and figuring out how to do something that helps everyone. And I think that's true for all of us, that we ought to step back for a moment from this very pitched battle that's going on and ask ourselves, if we are principled, what can we do to help the underprivileged, and especially those who face racial discrimination and barriers because of stereotypes and whatnot? I don't want to make it into racists and victims. There are just certain cultural stereotypes and barriers that exist out there that aren't being perpetrated by a single evil person or group of people, but that we all participate in. If you just watch TV, if you watch reruns from the 70s and 80s, or even TV that's on today, the images that you see of black people, it's really, I think that's what we need to fight.
All right, let's move on and look at another issue, I think, that's associated here, the question of the English-only movement. Many people who are not Native Americans but are Asian Americans have a noticeable accent. And at least in some of the things that I've read of yours, you think that too gives you a kind of interesting perspective on the question of the English-only movement in this country. Perhaps you can say a little bit about the English-only movement and the perspective that you think Asian Americans can add to that discussion.
Sure. You know, this is a very interesting movement. I think it's mainly symbolic because, really, when you think about it, how bad is it that there are people who speak other languages? You know, in our global marketplace, as we try to figure out, well, how are we going to compete with Europe and Asia and how are we going to move into the future, we really ought to be encouraging people to speak as many languages as they can. You know, we're the only country around that's aggressively pursuing a policy where we don't want people to know other languages. If you meet Europeans or Asians, they've been studying English and lots of other languages in addition to their native language since they were kids. And the other funny thing about this particular movement, you know, is a lot of the people who promote it are also these folks who think, well, the government should never legislate anything and shouldn't tell people what to do, and yet with English only, suddenly they want the government to officially declare something that we all know to be true. We all agree, you know, that if you want to do well in this society, be part of this society, you have to speak English. The question then is, well, is it okay if you speak something else at home with your kids, or if you maintain your ancestry and your culture? Is that okay? And I don't think that's a bad thing. I think that's a wonderful thing. I think that's something we ought to be encouraging, not just for Asian Americans, for all of us. You know, I think it'd be wonderful if people with French ancestry picked up a little French, and people with German ancestry learned German. But I think a lot of what this has to do isn't people who don't speak English at all. What this has to do is with people you and I both run into, we all run into, who speak English, but with an accent, with a lilting accent from their native land when they learned how to speak English in the classroom. And yet that accent throws people off, although we all know, we all have accents, you know. There are Southern accents that are wonderful accents. I think we ought to be more tolerant of these accents. We ought to recognize that these are people trying to speak the same language we all speak, but it's very difficult to raise people's accents. And we also, the interesting thing about accents, I think anyone with a Southern accent will realize this is true if they think about when they are outside of the South. We don't treat all accents equally. You know, if you have a French accent, that's sexy. If you have, you know, certain accents that shows you're well-educated. But suddenly, if you have an Asian Indian accent, well, that's not a good thing. If you have a Chinese accent, that's not a good thing. And so accents aren't all equal. And I just want to point that out and have us reflect on the English-only movement not being about teaching all of us English, but really being about singling out people. It's a form of hazing. It's a form of punishing people who are already trying to learn the language.
Well, I wonder, I mean, I think that's true, at least from my own experience, but does this fear or unease around someone with a different accent really reflect something deeper, which is an unease or a fear of difference?
Oh, I think so. I think you're right there. And I want to acknowledge something. I want to acknowledge that there are a lot of very real tensions that we face. And there are Asian Americans who can also be racist or racially insensitive toward whites or toward blacks. But the important thing is, having recognized that we work together to solve these problems. Not that we pursue these divisive us-them ways of dealing with these issues, but that when we see these tensions that arise from the rapidly changing demographics of this country, that we look at them honestly and cooperatively. That's what I think we ought to be doing.
Okay, and seeing the difference is not as something to be feared, not as something to be shunned, not as something to reject or to send back or to refuse entrance into this country, but as a source of diversity which can make our lives and our culture more interesting.
Right. Oh, absolutely. And not just our lives and our culture, but it can help American businesses. Look, if you want to compete with Japan and China, what would be better than having a lot of people who speak Japanese and Chinese and know their culture? You know, that's how they've been able to compete successfully with the United States. So I think we're moving toward a world where a lot of these lines become more fluid, and Asian Americans can help bridge that gap, and we can all help bridge that gap, you know, as we grow closer to Europe as well.
Well, it's interesting, though, when you say that we're moving to a time where there's more communication, more interaction within countries. That really leads us to the last issue I wanted to discuss a bit, which is immigration, because there is a fairly strong movement in this country which says, basically close the borders. Don't let any more people in, or if we let people in, only a very few and a very select few. Do you have some reflections on the current mood of the country, which appears to be fairly strongly anti-immigration?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, frighteningly so. You know, I think this is one of the most interesting areas, especially when you juxtapose it to civil rights and affirmative action, because you know, you hear conservative demagogues, I would say, although actually they've become mainstream politicians, folks like Pat Buchanan, say, well, we ought to be colorblind when it comes to affirmative action. We shouldn't have affirmative action because that wouldn't mean being colorblind. That would mean helping people because of their race. Well, when you take a look at this issue, suddenly the same people who were insisting we ought to be colorblind, well, they're very color conscious. They can see the race of the people who want to come. The people who want to come now are predominantly Asian and Latino. They're not white Europeans. And I think it's not just happenstance that suddenly we want to close the door when the people who want to come in are people of color. And I think it's really unfortunate. But this is one of the few areas where people will openly acknowledge that this is a racial issue. People will stand up and say, well, this is a white country, and we want it to remain a white country, or it's culturally a Anglo-Saxon Protestant country. And on this issue, I think here's another opportunity for all of us to look at principles. If all of us just think for a moment at our own ancestry, at the fact that our own grandparents or parents, whether or not we're Asian, Latino, or white, or African, faced barriers when they wanted to come here, then we can be more tolerant and more humane. Because when you think about it, at the turn of the century and through the 1920s and 30s, the movement then, which is the same thing we see now, the movement then was to bar all Asians. No Asians at all could come in. And not only that, you know, they didn't like Catholics and Jews and Southern Europeans. So we all of our parents and grandparents have faced some of the same bias against the newcomer, you know, this nativist sentiment. And there, I think, when you look at the racial and cultural motivations, you really have to be troubled. And I don't mean that everyone who wants to close the borders is a racist. I just mean we ought to pause and think about this and think, is it a coincidence that when all these people who are Asian and Latino who formerly couldn't come, you know, legally couldn't come into the United States, suddenly now want to come under the 1965 laws that reformed the system, now we want to slam the door closed. Is that really the message that we want to send? And it's not just about immigrants. It's about citizens. Because how do you think it makes Asian Americans feel when we see our fellow citizens say, we don't want any more Asians? You know, that means not just that they don't want anyone else coming in, but, well, we wish we could get rid of the ones who are already here, but we can't, you know. So I think this is a very dangerous issue. It's one of the issues that's going to be with us for a long time.
All right, we've got about a minute and a half left. I wonder if you could sort of summarize what you see as the insights that Asian Americans can add to the issues of race relations, et cetera.
Well, I think one of the insights is that there's no simple answer. You know, by throwing Asian Americans in, it gets very confusing, and I think that's good. I think we ought to recognize this is a difficult issue. This is a rich subject that we ought to discuss and think about and work together on. It's not a simple matter of labels and catchphrases, and so we're not going to find the easy out. But I think we also ought to realize we make these things up as we go along. Race is a matter of our perception. And how do I mean that? I mean that because Asian American, you know, that's an artificial category. That's just a census category. You know, it used to be we were Orientals or we were Chinese or Japanese, and then we became Chinese Americans and Japanese Americans, and then over time we became Asian Americans. And that transition has occurred because our perceptions have changed. Not just the perceptions of Asian Americans themselves, but the perceptions of other people has changed so that we see these commonalities. And Asian American is a coalition. It's a coalition of Chinese Americans, Japanese Americans, Korean Americans, Vietnamese Americans, you know, 20 or so different groups. And that coalition building approach is what I wish we could take. A coalition-building approach to building bridges, not just among ethnic groups within a race, but across racial divides. So if there's one lesson I think can be learned from the Asian American example, it's the lesson of building bridges.
Well, thank you very much for being with us this evening.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
I've been talking with Frank Wu, professor in the School of Law at Howard University, and we've been discussing the topic, Neither Black Nor White, Asian Americans and Race Relations. This has been Hugh LaFollette for Ideas and Issues. Good evening.